Hello, and thanks for joining us, everyone, at 1001 Stories for the Road. And now, Chapter 19, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, by Mark Twain. 2 or 3 days and nights went by. I reckon I might say they swum by. They slid along so quiet and smooth and lovely. Here is the way we put in the time. It was a monstrous big river down there, sometimes a mile and a half wide. We run nights, and laid up and hid daytimes. Soon as night was most gone, we stopped navigating and tied up, nearly always in the dead water under a towhead, and then cut young cottonwoods and willows, and hid the raft with them. Then we set out the lines. Next we slid into the river and had a swim, so as to freshen up and cool off. Then we sat down on the sandy bottom, where the water was about knee-deep, and watched the daylight come. Not a sound anywheres. Perfectly still. Just like the whole world was asleep. Only sometimes the bullfrogs a-cluttering, maybe. The first thing to see, looking away over the water, was a kind of dull line. That was the woods on the other side. You couldn't make nothing else out. Then a pale place in the sky. Then more paleness spreading around. Then the river softened up away off, and weren't black anymore, but gray. You could see little dark spots drifting along ever so far away, trading scows and such things, and long black streaks, rafts. Sometimes you could hear a sweep creaking, or jumbled up voices. It was so still, and sounds come so far. And by, you could see a streak on the water, which you knew by the look of the streak, that there's a snag there in a swift current which breaks on it and makes that streak look that way. And you see the mist curl up off the water, and the east reddens up, and the river, and you make out a log cabin in the edge of the woods, away on the bank on the other side of the river, being a woodyard, likely, and piled by them cheats so you can throw a dog through it anywheres. Then the nice breeze springs up and comes fanning you from over there, so cool and fresh and sweet to smell on account of the woods and the flowers. But sometimes not that way, because they've left dead fish laying around, gars and such, and they do get pretty rank. And next you've got the full day, and everything's smiling in the sun, and the songbirds just going it. A little smoke couldn't be noticed now, so we would take some fish off the lines and cook up a hot breakfast. And afterwards we would watch the lonesomeness of the river, and kind of lazy along, and by lazy off to sleep. Wake up by and by, and look to see what done it, and maybe see a steamboat coughing along upstream, so far off towards the other side you couldn't tell nothing about her, only whether she was a stern wheel or a side wheel. Then for about an hour there wouldn't be nothing to hear or nothing to see, just solid lonesomeness. Next you'd see a raft sliding by, away off yonder, and maybe a galoot on it chopping, because they're most always doing it on a raft. You see the axe flash and come down. You don't hear nothing. You see that axe go up again, and by the time it's above the man's head, then you hear the ka-chunk. And it took all that time to come over the water. So we would put in the day, lazing around, listening to the stillness. Once there was a thick fog, and the rafts and things that went by was beating tin pans so the steamboats wouldn't run over them. A scow or a raft went by so close we could hear them talking and cussing and laughing. Heard them plain, but we couldn't see no sign of them. It made you feel crawly. It was like spirits carrying on that way in the air. Jim said he believed it was spirits, but I says, "Nah, spirits wouldn't say, 'Durn the durn fog.'" Soon as it was night out, we shoved. When we got her out to about the middle, we let her alone, and let her float wherever the current wanted her to. Then we lit the pipes and dangled our legs in the water and talked about all kinds of things. We was always naked, day and night, whenever the mosquitoes would let us. The new clothes Buck's folks made for me was too good to be comfortable, and besides, I didn't go much on clothes nohow. Sometimes we'd have that whole river all to ourselves for the longest time. Yonder was the banks and the islands across the water, and maybe a spark, which was a candle on a cabin window. And sometimes on the water you could see a spark or two, on a raft or a scow, you know? And maybe you could hear a fiddle or a song coming over from one of them crafts. It's lovely to live on a raft. We had the sky up there, all speckled with stars, and we used to lay on our backs and look up at them, and discuss about whether they was made or only just happened. Jim, he allowed they was made, but I allowed they happened. I judged it would have took too long to make so many. Jim said the moon could have laid them. Well, that looked kind of reasonable, so I didn't say nothing against it, because I've seen a frog lay most as many, so of course it could be done.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
We used to watch the stars that fell, too, and see them streak down. Jim allowed they'd got spoiled and was hove out of the nest. Once or twice of a night we would see a steamboat slipping along in the dark, and now and then she would belch a whole world of sparks up out of her chimbleys, and they would rain down in the river and look awful pretty. Then she would turn a corner, and her lights would wink out, and her powwow shut off and leave the river still again. And by her waves would get to us, a long time after she was gone, and joggle the raft a bit. And then you wouldn't hear nothing, for you couldn't tell how long, except maybe frogs or something. After midnight, the people on shore went to bed, and then for 2 or 3 hours the shores was black. No more sparks in the cabin windows. These sparks was our clock. The first one that showed again meant morning was coming. So we hunted a place to hide and tie up right away. One morning about daybreak, I found a canoe and crossed over a chute to the main shore. It was only 200 yards, and paddled about a mile up a creek amongst the cypress woods to see if I couldn't get some berries. Just as I was passing a place where a kind of cow path crossed the creek, here comes a couple of men tearing up the path as tight as they could put it. I thought I was a goner. For whenever anybody was after anybody, I judged it was me, or maybe Jim. I was about to dig out from there in a hurry, but they was pretty close to me then, and sung out and begged me to save their lives, and said they hadn't been doing nothing, and was being chased for it. Said there was men and dogs a-coming. They wanted to jump right in, but I says, "Don't you do it. I don't hear the dogs and horses yet. You got time to crowd through the brush and get up the creek a little ways. Then you take to the water and wade down to me and get in. That'll throw the dogs off the scent." Well, they done it, and as soon as they was aboard, I lit out for our towhead, and in about 5 or 10 minutes we heard the dogs and the men away off shouting. We heard them come along towards the creek, but couldn't see them. They seemed to stop and fool around a while. Then as we got further and further away all the time, we couldn't hardly hear them at all. By the time we had left a mile of woods behind us, and struck the river, everything was quiet, and we paddled over to the towhead and hid in the cottonwoods, and were safe. One of these fellows was about 70 or upwards, and had a bald head and very gray whiskers. He had an old battered-up slouch hat on, and a greasy blue woolen shirt, and ragged old blue jean breeches stuffed into his boot tops, and home-knit galooses. He had an old long-tailed blue jeans coat with slick brass buttons flung over his arm, and both of them had big, fat, ratty-looking carpet bags. The other fellow was about 30 and dressed about as ornery. After breakfast, we all laid off and talked, and the first thing that come out was that these chaps didn't know one another. "What got you into trouble?" says the bald head to the other chap. Well, I'd been selling an article to take the tartar off the teeth, and it does take it off, too, and generally the enamel along with it. But I stayed about one night longer than I ought to, and was just in the act of sliding out when I ran across you on the trail this side of town, and you told me they were coming, and begged me to help you to get off. So I told you I was expecting trouble myself, and would scatter out with you. That's the whole yarn. What's yourn? Well, I'd been a-running a little temperance revival there about a week, and was the pet of women folks, big and little, for I was making it mighty warm for the rummies, I tell you, and taking as much as $5 or $6 a night. 10 cents a head. Children free. And business a-growing all the time. When somehow or other a little report got around last night that I had a way of putting in my time with a private jug on the sly. Well, someone rousted me out this morning and told me the people was gathering on the quiet with their dogs and horses, and they'd be along pretty soon and give me about half an hour's start, and then run me down if they could. And if they got me, they'd tar and feather me and ride me on the rail, sure. I didn't wait for no breakfast. I weren't hungry when I heard that. "Old man," said the young one, "I reckon we might double-team it together. What do you think?" "I ain't undisposed. What's your line, mainly?" "A printer by trade. I do a little in patent medicines. Theater actor. Tragedy, you know. Take a turn to mesmerism and phrenology when there's a chance. Teach singing geography school for a change. I sling a lecture sometimes. Oh, I do lots of things. Most anything that comes handy. So it ain't work. What's your lay?" "I'd done considerable in the doctrine way in my time. Laying on of hands is my best holt, for cancer and paralysis, and such things. And I can tell a fortune pretty good when I got somebody along to find out the facts for me. Preaching's my line, too, and working camp meetings, and missionarying around." Nobody ever said anything for a while. Then the young man hove a sigh and says, "Alas!" "What are you lassing about?" says the bald head. "To think I should have lived to be leading such a life, and be degraded into such company." And he began to wipe the corner of his eye with a rag. "Durn your skin, ain't the company good enough for you?" says the bald head, pretty pert and uppish. "Yes, it is good enough for me. It's as good as I deserve, for who fetched me so low when I was so high? I did myself. I don't blame you, gentlemen. Far from it. I don't blame anybody. I deserve it all. Let the cold world do its worst. One thing I know, there's a grave somewhere for me. The world may go on just as it's always done and take everything from me. Loved ones, property, everything. But I can't take that. Someday I'll lie down in it and forget it all, and my poor broken heart will be at rest." And he went on a-wiping. "Drat your poor broken heart," said the bald head. "What are you heaving your poor broken heart at us for? We ain't done nothing." "No, I know you haven't. I ain't blaming you, gentlemen. I brought myself down. Yep, I did it myself. It's right I should suffer. Perfectly right. I don't make any moan." "Brought you down from wire. What was you brought down from?" "Ah, you would not believe me. The world never believes. Let it pass. 'Tis no matter. The secret of my birth."
"The secret of your birth? Do you mean to say?"
"Gentlemen," says the young man, very solemn, "I will reveal it to you, for I feel I may have confidence in you. By rights, I am a duke." Jim's eyes bugged out when he heard that, and reckon mine did too. Then the bald head says, "Nah, you can't mean it." "Yes, my great-grandfather, eldest son of the Duke of Bridgewater, fled to this country about the end of the last century to breathe the pure air of freedom. Married here and died, leaving a son, his own father dying about the same time. The second son of the late Duke seized the titles and estates. The infant real Duke was ignored. I am the lineal descendant of that infant. I am the rightful Duke of Bridgewater. And here I am, forlorn,
torn from my high estate, hunted of men, despised by the cold world, ragged, worn, heartbroken, and degraded to the companionship of felons on a raft. Jim pitied him ever so much, and so did I. We tried to comfort him, but he said it weren't much use. He couldn't be much comforted. Said if we was a mind to acknowledge him, that would do him more good than most anything else. So we said we would, if he would tell us how. He said we ought to bow when we spoke to him and say, Your Grace, or My Lord, or Your Lordship. And he wouldn't mind if we called him Plain Bridgewater, which he said was a title anyway, and not a name, and one of us ought to wait on him at dinner and do any little thing for him he wanted done. Well, all that was easy, so we done it. All through dinner, Jim stood around and waited on him and says, Will Your Grace have some of this or some of that? And so on, and a body could see he was mighty pleasing to him. But the old man got pretty silent by and by, didn't have much to say, and didn't look pretty comfortable over all that petting that was going on around that duke. He seemed to have something on his mind. So, along in the afternoon, he says, "'Looky here, Bilgewater,' he says. "'I'm nation sorry for you, but you ain't the only person that's had troubles like that.' "'No? No, you ain't. You ain't the only person that's been snaked down wrongfully out of high place.' "'Alas! No, you ain't the only person that's had a secret of his birth.' And by jings, he begins to cry. Hold, what do you mean? Bridgewater, can I trust you? Says the old man, still sort of sobbing. To the bitter death. He took the old man by the hand and squeezed it and says, That secret of your being? Bilgewater, I'm the late Dolphin. Jim and me stared this time. Then the Duke says, You're what? Yes, my friend, it's too true. Your eyes is looking at this very moment on the poor disappeared Dolphin, Louis the 17th, son of Louis the 16th, and Mary Antoinette. You? At your age? No. You mean you're the late Charlemagne? You must be 600 or 700 years old, at the very least. Trouble has done it, Bilgewater. Trouble has done it. Trouble has brung these gray hairs and this premature baldness. Yes, gentlemen, you see before you, in blue jeans and misery, the wandering, exiled, trampled on, and suffering rightful King of France. Well, he cried and took on so that me and Jim didn't know hardly what to do. We were so sorry and so glad and proud we'd got him with us, too. So we set in like we'd done before with the Duke and tried to comfort him. But he said it warn't no use. Nothing but to be dead and done with it all could do him any good. Though he said it often made him feel easier and better for a while if people treated him according to his rights and got down on one knee to speak to him and always called him Your Majesty and waited on him first at meals and didn't set down in his presence till he asked them. So Jim and me set the Majesty in him and doing this and that and the other for him and standing up till he told us we might set down. This done him heaps of good, and so he got cheerful and comfortable. But the Duke kind of soured on him, didn't look a bit satisfied with the way things was going. Still, the King acted real friendly towards him, and said the Duke's great-grandfather and all the other Dukes of Bilgewater was a good deal thought of by his father, and was allowed to come to the palace considerable. But the Duke stayed huffy a good while, till by and by the King says, Like as not we got to be together a blame long time on this here raft, Bilgewater. And so what's the use of your being sour? It'll only make things uncomfortable. It ain't my fault I weren't born a Duke. It ain't your fault you weren't born a King. So what's the use to worry? Make the best of things the way you find 'em, says I. That's my motto. This ain't no bad thing that we've struck here. Plenty grub and easy life. Come, give us your hand, Duke. Let's all be friends. Well, the Duke done it, and Jim and me was pretty glad to see it. It took away all the uncomfortableness, and we felt mighty good over it, because it would have been a miserable business to have any unfriendliness on the raft. For what you want, above all things, on a raft, is for everybody to be satisfied and feel right and kind toward the others. It didn't take me long to make up my mind that these liars weren't no kings nor dukes at all, but just low-down humbugs and frauds. But I never said nothing, never let on, kept it to myself. It's the best way. Then you don't have no quarrels, and don't get into no trouble. If they wanted us to call them kings and dukes, I had no objections, long as it would keep peace in the family, and it weren't no use to tell Jim, so I didn't tell him. If I never learned nothing else out of Pap, I learned that the best way to get along with his kind of people is to let them have their own way. They asked us considerable many questions. Wanted to know what we covered up the raft that way for, and laid by in the daytime instead of running. Was Jim a runaway? Says I, goodness sakes. Would a runaway run south? No, they allowed he wouldn't. I had to account for things some way, so I says, my folks was living in Pike County in Missouri, where I was born, and they all died off but me and Pa and my brother Ike. Pa, he allowed me to break up and go down and live with Uncle Ben, who's got a little one-horse place on the river, 44 miles below Orleans. Pa was pretty poor and had some debts, so when he squared up, there weren't nothing left but $16 and our slave, Jim. That weren't enough to take us 1,400 miles, deck passage, nor no other way. Well, when the river rose, Pa had a streak of luck one day. He catched this piece of raft, so we reckoned we'd go down to Orleans on it. Pa's luck didn't hold out. A steamboat run over the forward corner of the raft one night, and we all went overboard and dove under the wheel. Jim and me come up all right, but Pa was drunk, and Ike was only 4 years old, so they never come up no more. Well, for the next day or two, we had considerable trouble, because people was always coming out in skiffs and trying to take Jim away from me, saying they believed he was a runaway slave. We don't run daytimes no more now. Nights, they don't bother us. The Duke says, leave me alone to cipher out a way so we can run in the daytime if we want to. I'll think the thing over. I'll invent a plan that'll fix it. We'll let it alone for today. Because, of course, we don't want to go by that town yonder in daylight. It mightn't be healthy. Towards night it begun to darken up and look like rain. The heat lightning was squirting around low in the sky, and the leaves was beginning to shiver. It was going to be pretty ugly. It was easy to see that. So the Duke and the King went to overhaul in our wigwam to see what the beds was like. My bed was a straw tick, better than Jim's, which was a corn shuck tick. There's always cobs round about in a shuck tick, and they poke into you and hurt. When you roll over, the dry shuck sound like you was rolling over in a pile of dead leaves. It makes such a rustling that you wake up. Well, the Duke allowed he would take my bed, but the King allowed he wouldn't. He says, I should have reckoned the difference in rank would have suggested to you that a corn shuck bed wasn't just fitting for me to sleep on. Your Grace, I'll take the shuck bed yourself. Jim and me was in a sweat again for a minute, being afraid there was going to be some more trouble amongst them. So we was pretty glad when the Duke says, "'Tis my fate to be always ground into the mire under the iron heel of oppression. Misfortune has broken my once haughty spirit. I yield, I submit. 'Tis my fate. I'm alone in the world. Let me suffer, I can bear it.' We got away as soon as it was good and dark. The King told us to stand well out towards the middle of the river and not show a light till we got a long ways below the town. We come in sight of the little bunch of lights by and by, that was the town, you know, and slid by, about a half mile out, all right. When we was 3/4 of a mile below, we hoisted up our signal lantern, and about 10 o'clock it come on to rain and blow and thunder and lighten like everything. So the King told us to both stay on watch till the weather got better. Then him and the Duke crawled into the wigwam and turned in for the night. It was my watch below till 12, but I wouldn't have turned in anyway if I'd have had a bed, because a body don't see such a storm as that every day in the week, not by a long sight. My souls, how the wind did scream along, and every second or two
there had come a glare that lit up the whitecaps for half a mile around, and you see the islands looking dusty through the rain, and the trees thrashing around in the wind. Then comes an H-whack, bum-blum-bum, bum-bum, and the thunder would go rumbling and grumbling away, and quit. And then rip comes another flash, and another sockdolliger. The waves most washed me off the raft sometimes, but I hadn't any clothes on, and I didn't mind. We didn't have no trouble about snags. The lightning was glaring and fluttering around so constant that we could see them pretty soon enough to throw her head this way or that and miss them. I had the middle watch, you know, but I was pretty sleepy by that time, so Jim, he said he'd stand the first half of it for me. He was always mighty good that way, Jim was. I crawled into the wigwam, but the king and the duke had their legs sprawled around, so there weren't no show for me, so I laid outside. I didn't mind the rain, because it was warm, and the waves weren't running so high now. About 2, they came up again, though, and Jim was going to call me, but he changed his mind, because he reckoned they weren't high enough yet to do any harm. But he was mistaken about that, for pretty soon, all of a sudden, along comes a regular ripper and washed me overboard. It most killed Jim a-laughing. He was the easiest guy to laugh that ever was, anyway. I took the watch, and Jim, he laid down and snored away. And by, the storm lit up for good and all, and the first cabin light that showed, I rousted him out, and we slid the raft into hiding quarters for the day. The king got out an old ratty deck of cards after breakfast, and him and the duke played 7-up for a while, 5 cents a game. Then they got tired of it, and allowed they would lay out a campaign, as they called it. The duke went down into his carpet bag and fetched up a lot of little printed bills and read them out loud. One bill said, "The celebrated Dr. Armand de Montauban of Paris would lecture on the science of phrenology at such and such a place on the blank day of blank at 10 cents admission, and furnish charts of character at 25 cents apiece." The duke said that was him. In another bill, he was the world-renowned Shakespearean tragedian, Garrick the Younger of Drury Lane, London. In other bills, he had a lot of other names and done other wonderful things, like finding water and gold with a divining rod, dissipating witch spells, and so on. And by, he says, "But the histrionic muse is the darling. Have you ever trod the boards, royalty?" "No," says the king. "You shall, then, before you're 3 days older, fallen grandeur," says the duke. "The first good town we come to, we'll hire a hall and do the sword fight in Richard the Third, and the balcony scene in Romeo and Juliet. How does that strike you?" "I'm in, up to the hub, for anything that'll pay, Bilgewater. But you see, I don't know nothing about play-acting, and ain't ever seen much of it. I was too small when Pap used to have 'em at the palace. You reckon you can learn me?" "Easy." "All right. I'm just a-freezing for something fresh anyway. Let's commence right away." So the duke, he told him all about who Romeo was and who Juliet was, and said he was used to being Romeo, so the king could play Juliet. "But if Juliet's such a young gal, duke, my peeled head and my white whiskers is going to look uncommon odd on her." "No, don't you worry. These country jakes won't ever think of that. Besides, you know, you'll be in costume, and that makes all the difference in the world. Juliet's in a balcony enjoying the moonlight before she goes to bed, and she's got on her nightgown and her ruffled nightcap. Here are the costumes for the parts." Out of his carpet bag, he got 2 or 3 curtain calico suits, which he said was a medieval armor for Richard the Third and the other chap, and a long white cotton nightshirt and a ruffled nightcap to match. The king was satisfied, so the duke got out his book and read the parts over in the most splendid spread-eagle way, prancing around and acting at the same time to show how it had to be got done. Then he gave the book to the king and told him to get his part down by heart. There was a little one-horse town about 3 miles down the bend, and after dinner, the duke said he'd ciphered out his idea about how to run in daylight without it being dangersome for Jim. so he allowed he would go down to the town and fix that thing. The king allowed he would go, too, and see if he couldn't strike something. We was out of coffee, so Jim said I'd better go along with them in the canoe and get some. When we got there, there weren't nobody stirring, streets empty, but perfectly dead and still, like a Sunday. We found a sick man sunning himself in a backyard, and he said everybody that weren't too young or too sick or too old was gone to a camp meeting about 2 miles back in the woods. The king got the directions and allowed he'd go and work that camp meeting for all it was worth, and I might go too. The duke said what he was after was a printing office. We found it, a little bit of a concern, up over a carpenter shop. Carpenters and printers all gone to the meeting, and no doors locked. It was a dirty, littered-up place, and had ink marks and handbills with pictures of horses and runaway slaves on them, all over the walls. The duke shed his coat and said he was all right now, so me and the king lit out for the camp meeting. We got there in about a half an hour, fairly dripping, for it was a most awful hot day. There was as much as 1,000 people there from 20 miles around. The woods was full of teams and wagons hitched everywheres, feeding out of the wagon troughs and stomping to keep off the flies. There was sheds made out of poles and roofed over with branches, where they had lemonade and gingerbread to sell, and piles of watermelons and green corn and such like. The preaching was going on under the same kind of sheds, only they was bigger and held crowds of people. The benches was made out of outside slabs of logs with holes bored in the round side to drive sticks into them for legs. They didn't have no backs. The preachers had high platforms to stand on at one end of the sheds. The women had on sunbonnets, and some had on linsey-woolsey frocks, some gingham ones, and a few of the young ones had on calico. Some of the young men was barefooted, and some of the children didn't have on any clothes but just a tow linen shirt. Some of the old women was knitting, and some of the young folks was courting on the sly. The first shed we come to, the preacher was lining out a hymn. He lined out 2 lines. Everybody sung it, and it was kind of grand to hear it. There was so many of them, and they done it in such a rousing way. Then he lined out 2 more for them to sing, and so on. The people woke up more and more, and sung louder and louder, and towards the end, some began to groan, and some began to shout. Then the preacher begun to preach, and begun in earnest, too, and went weaving first to one side of the platform, and then the other, and then a-leaning down over the front of it, with his arms and body going all the time, and shouting his words out with all his might. And every now and then he would hold up his Bible and spread it open, and kind of pass it around this way and that, shouting, "It's the brazen serpent in the wilderness. Look upon it and live." People would shout out, "Glory! Amen!" And so he went on, and the people groaning and crying and saying, "Amen. Oh, come to the mourner's bench. Come, black with sin. Amen. Come, sick and sore. Amen. Come, lame and halt and blind. Come, poor and needy, sunk in shame. Come, all that's worn and soiled and suffering, come with a broken spirit. Come with a contrite heart. Come in your rags and sin and dirt. The waters that cleanse is free. The door of heaven stands open. Oh, enter in and be at rest. Amen. Glory, glory, hallelujah." And so on. You couldn't make out what the preacher said any more on account of the shouting and crying now. Folks got up everywheres in the crowd and worked their way just by main strength to the mourner's bench, with the tears running down their faces. And when all the mourners had got up there to the front benches in the crowd, they sung and shouted and flung themselves down on the straw, just crazy and wild. Well, the first I knowed, the king got a-going, and you could hear him over everybody. And next he went a-charging on up to the platform. And the preacher, he begged him to speak to the people, and he done it. He told them he was a pirate, been a pirate for 30 years out in the Indian Ocean, and his crew was thinned out considerable last spring in a fight, and he was home now to take out some fresh men, and thanks to goodness he'd been robbed last night
and put ashore off a steamboat without a cent, and he was glad of it, as it was the blessedest thing that ever happened to him, because he was a changed man now, and happy for the first time in his life. And poor as he was a-going to start right off and work his way back to the Indian Ocean, and put in the rest of his life trying to turn the pirates into the true path, for he could do it better than anybody else, being acquainted with all the pirate crews in that ocean, and though it would take him a long time to get there without money, he would get there anyway. And every time he convinced a pirate, he would say to him, "Don't you thank me? Don't you give me no credit. It all belongs to them dear people in Polkville Camp Meeting, natural brothers and benefactors of the race, and that dear preacher there, the truest friend a pirate ever had." And then he busted into tears. And so did everybody. Then somebody sings out, "Take up a collection for him! Take up a collection!" Well, half a dozen made a jump to do it, but somebody sings out, "Let him pass the hat around." Then everybody said it, and the preacher too. So the king went all through the crowd with his hat swabbing his eyes and blessing the people and praising them and thanking them for being so good to the poor pirates away off there. And every little while the prettiest kind of girls, with tears running down their cheeks, would up and ask him would he let them kiss him for to remember him by. And he always done it. And some of them he hugged, and kissed as many as 5 or 6 times. And he was invited to stay a week, and everybody wanted him to live in their houses, and said they'd think it was an honor. But he said as this was the last day of the camp meeting, he couldn't do no good. And besides, he was in a sweat to get back to the Indian Ocean right off and get to work on the pirates. When we got back to the raft, and he come to count up, he found he'd collected $87.65. And then he'd fetched away a 3-gallon jug of whiskey, too, that he found under a wagon when he was starting home to the woods. The king said, "Take it all around. It laid over any day he'd ever put in the missionary line." He said it weren't no use talking. Heathens don't amount to shucks alongside of pirates to work a camp meeting with. The duke was thinking he'd been doing pretty well till the king come to show up. But after that, he didn't think so much. He had set up and printed off 2 little jobs for farmers in that printing office, horse bills, and took the money, $4. And he had got in $10 worth of advertisements for the paper, which he said he'd put in for $4 if they'd pay in advance. So they done it. The price of the paper was $2 a year, but he took in 3 subscriptions for $0.50 apiece on condition of them paying him in advance. They were going to pay in cordwood and onions as usual, but he said he had just bought the concern and knocked down the price as low as he could afford it and was going to run it for cash. He set up a little piece of poetry, which he made himself out of his own head, 3 verses, kind of sweet and saddish. The name of it was, "Yes, Crush Cold World, This Breaking Heart." And he left that all set up and ready to print in the paper and didn't charge nothing for it. Well, he took in $9.50 and said he'd done a pretty square day's work for it. Then he showed us another little job he'd printed and hadn't charged for, because it was for us. It had a picture of a runaway slave with a bundle on a stick over his shoulder, and $200 reward under it. The reading was all about Jim, and just described him to a dot. It said he'd run away from St. Jacques Plantation, 40 miles below New Orleans, last winter, and likely went north, and whoever would catch him and send him back, he could have the reward and expenses. "Now," says the duke, "after tonight, we can run in the daytime if we want to. Whenever we see anybody coming, we can tie Jim hand and foot with a rope and lay him in the wigwam and show this handbill and say we captured him up the river and we're too poor to travel on a steamboat, so we got this little raft on credit from our friends and are going down to get the reward. Handcuffs and chains would still look better on Jim, but it wouldn't go well with the story of us being so poor. Too much like jewelry. Ropes are the correct thing. We must preserve the unities, as we say on the boards." We all said the duke was pretty smart, and there couldn't be no trouble about running daytimes. We judged we could make miles enough that night to get out of the reach of the powwow. We laid low and kept still and never shoved out till nearly 10 o'clock. Then we slid by, pretty wide away from the town,
and didn't hoist our lantern till we was clear out of sight of it. When Jim called me to take the watch at 4 a.m, he says, "Huck, does you reckon we gwine to run across any more kings on dis trip?"
"No," I says, "I reckon not."
"Well," says he, "that's all right then. I don't mind one or two kings, but that's enough. This one's powerful drunk, and the Duke ain't much better." I found Jim had been trying to get him to talk French so he could hear what it was like, but he said he'd been in this country so long and had so much trouble, he'd forgot it. Join us next week for chapters 21 and 22, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn by Mark Twain. See you next week.
With everything you have on your plate, earning your degree online seems impossible. But at Grand Canyon University, we specialize in helping you fit a master's degree in education into your busy day. Your graduation team, led by your own GCU counselor, provides you with the personal support you need to succeed. Achieve your goals with a plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.